Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezrich. Today we're going to dive in to the very first impeachment of a sitting president, which would occur almost a century after the ratification of the U.S. Constitution that lays out how to impeach a president or judge or other elected or even administration officials. For this conversation, I'm joined by award-winning writer Brenda Wineapple. She is the author of the book, The Impeachers, The Trial of Andrew Johnson, and The Dream of a Just Nation. Brenda Wineapple, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to this radio program.
Thank you for having me. My pleasure.
This is one of the most fascinating stories that for most of my life, I didn't even know about. And then once I learned this story about the impeachment of Andrew Johnson in 1868, now when I tell other people, I realize they didn't know about this story either, and they're pretty amazed when they hear about it. Now, my understanding is you actually now, of course, everyone's thinking about impeachment right now because of what's happening with Donald Trump. But my understanding is you started writing this book back in what, 2014?
2013, actually. Excuse me. We were deep in the Obama administration, and nobody was talking about impeachment. And in fact, if people asked me what I was working on and I told them, their eyes would glaze over and they'd find somebody more interesting to talk to. So it's amazing how things have changed.
What made you interested in this story?
Well, you know, my last book, called Ecstatic Nation, covered a very large period before, during, and after the Civil War. And when I was researching in that book and writing it, I realized that I had to touch down on the Johnson impeachment, but I really didn't know very much about it. And so as I began to dig in, and after I finished that particular book, I thought, why is it that I don't know about this event, which had to be a major event in American history? It was the first ever presidential impeachment, and it happened right after the Civil War, basically, and after the first ever presidential assassination. So to me, it seemed a remarkable event, and just as remarkable, like you, I didn't know very much about it. And, you know, I'm fairly well educated, and I've been working around in this period, and I thought, that's so interesting. So that's why I started. I started with two questions: what happened, and why don't I know about it?
What do you find interesting about this story?
I find everything interesting about this story.
Yeah, me too.
You know, from the very beginning, as I said, you know, imagine what it was like right after the Civil War. You have, you know, a presidential assassination, and you have a transfer of power. And the transfer of power went, you know, pretty smoothly. But how do you put the country back together again? And I realized, you know, I really didn't think that through. You know, we have a tendency when we think of American history and we think of presidents, we kind of go from one big one like Lincoln to another big one like Grant. And I thought, there's a 3-year interim, so I want to know what happened, who was in power, you know, how power was transferred, and how it was that all the things that I had learned, because I'd learned some things about the impeachment, that they were actually wrong. They had never set well with me. So I found it interesting the way the country was, you know, trying to put itself together. And I found it very interesting because Andrew Johnson was this, you know, in many ways, strange, unusual figure that seems to have, you know, almost called into being, you know, where we are today, because he was a demagogue, he went on rallies, he didn't listen to people. So I found that all interesting. And then the characters who were involved, the people who were involved, were, to my mind, larger than life. And they had a vision. They had a vision of a country that would go in a direction the likes of which was kind of mapped out in the Declaration. And, you know, a country where there was justice and equality.
You're talking about the radical Republicans.
Yes, and they were always labeled, at least from, you know, when I grew up, as maniacs, as, you know, too radical in a sense, and just kind of power hungry. And actually what I found out was, from my point of view anyway, they were visionary, and what they wanted to do is recreate the country, restore the union, but not to the way it was before, but rather to eradicate all the effects of slavery and make all citizens of the country equal, and to have an equal share in a representative government. And that, to me, was so extraordinary, because they were speaking as if they lived today, in terms of, you know, getting rid of what we call white supremacy.
That's really interesting to me, that these radical Republicans, through much of history until recently, and today I see them as hero-like figures.
Yeah.
But they were, but for much of history after their time, they were not portrayed as heroes.
No, they were vilified. And, you know, one of the questions I had is, why was that? And in a sense, the vantage point that I would consider Southern white supremacist had a kind of a hold on the historical imagination, probably to the 50s and 60s, and it really was part of popular culture. And you can see it in, you know, films that we don't watch today, but that, you know, we're sort of speaking to something in American culture, like The Birth of a Nation, 1915. You know, and of course people were horrified and picketed, but at the same time, it was a popular film and a popular vantage point. And what that did was, as I said, vilify, make the people like a rat, you know, like Thaddeus Stevens or Charles Sumner, people in Congress and people outside of them, kind of crazed. And they were crazed particularly because they didn't see any difference between black and white people. They thought, you know, people are people. So, you know, you see kind of a powerful, what we would call almost a Dixiecrat view of, you know, America, that was really very very strong, you know. And that's how, certainly in the popular imagination, that's how history was written. In fact, Johnson, you know, Johnson wasn't made into a hero, but if you think of the book Profiles in Courage by, you know, Kennedy, that came out in the late 50s, it won a Pulitzer, and in that book, even Kennedy, or whoever wrote that book, you know, was saying the Republicans were kind of extremists, and that the impeachment of Johnson was not for any good reason that affected the nation. That's remarkable, because the reason that they impeached Johnson was because he was trying to restore the 11 states of the South, you know, back into power without, you know, black people not just having the vote, but being citizens.
A lot to unpack there. Let me begin.
Sorry.
No, that's okay. No, I didn't mean that negatively. I meant that now we have a roadmap. And okay. I want to go back to somebody you mentioned earlier, Thaddeus Stevens. Who was Thaddeus Stevens?
I love his name. Don't you know his name, Thaddeus, anymore? So right there, he seems very colorful. One of the things, you know, a sort of thumbnail portrait that I can give of him, which is a very interesting person, originally born in Vermont and, you know, from Vermont, very poor, and came to be the representative from Pennsylvania. He was a long time, very strong abolitionist. And as I said, the thumbnail portrait of him is later in life when he was getting older and more feeble. He had bought a plot in a cemetery, you know, thinking of the end. And when he found out that the cemetery was segregated, he sold the plot and went to make sure that he was buried in a cemetery that was, you know, integrated, black and white, which is unusual there. And on his tombstone had effectively written that he wanted to stand for in death what he had always stood for in life, which was equal justice for all. Amazing, really, when you think about that. He died in 1868, so.
A staunch abolitionist. He was for female suffrage, wasn't he?
Well, yes, but he was one of those pragmatists, in a sense, that, that yes, theoretically, but he was determined to reconstruct the South to make sure first that black men got the vote. So, yeah, he was, he certainly was, but he wasn't going to fight for it then at that particular time.
And that's a big issue that I think many people don't realize is the 15th Amendment to the United States Constitution. There was debates that this should go beyond just black males, but include women.
Yeah, sure. Definitely. And that had happened, you know, that debate was even before it was in the 14th Amendment, too, because you talked about, you know, black male, you know, talk about males and put male into the word male into the Constitution would never have been before. And there was a big debate, say, led by at one sort of extreme by Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and at the other by Frederick Douglass, who basically said, look, you know, we are getting killed on the streets, black people, especially in the South. And, you know what Wendell Phillips said is, you know, black men have to go through the door first. And, you know, it was a very difficult kind of decision. But it's interesting because it's another conversation that has to do with basically sexism in this country. And, of course, as you know, women didn't get to vote until 1920, which is, a long time after the period we're talking about.
Yeah, almost 60 years. Thaddeus Stevens would also be known, and this wasn't considered this was more of a derogative towards him, as the dictator of Congress.
Yes, he was. You know, he became, in a sense, the poster boy for, you know, radicalism that was, as I said before, vilified, that was hated. And so he was considered, because he was a very deft parliamentarian, and because he knew all the rules of the House, he knew how to shape and push. You might think of him as the sort of good version, from my point of view anyway, of Mitch McConnell in the Senate, who really sort of knows how to, you know, manipulate the rules fairly, in a sense. I mean, you know, we might think unfairly, but legally. And Stevens could do that and was very sharp. But, you know, in a sense, to say he was the dictator means that everybody else is, you know, passive and has no choice. And that's really not what was going on at all. He was just extremely eloquent, extremely deft, and in many ways actually well-liked. He was feared, but also well-liked and very well-respected in the House. And you have to remember that the Republicans in the House, which was the Republicans were Lincoln's party, it's not the same party as today, and it was originally founded as an anti-slavery party. And, you know, it was divided in itself because anti-slavery might have linked all the members of the party, but they came from different locations, Republicans, and they had different, say, monetary views or different views about things. So part of what Stevens tried to do was unify them, but he stood on the progressive wing of that particular party.
Yeah, when we say radical Republicans, that's not the entire Republican Party. My understanding,
no.
It's even a minority within the Republican Party at the time, but yet, as radicals oftentimes are, a very influential part of the party.
Right. Well, you know, the radical Republicans were, you know, during the Civil War, just, you know, not before the period we're looking at, they were the ones that goaded or pushed or urged Lincoln to prosecute the war more quickly and more forcefully. So in a sense, you could say to us, you know, they had a tremendous influence on Lincoln, who was originally more moderate and in some ways more pragmatic. So, you know, you can see how politics works in that particular way. The interesting thing about what happened during the Johnson administration was that Johnson was such a difficult president that he inadvertently managed to fuse all elements of the Republican Party. He actually brought them more together you know, because they united when they finally voted to impeach him, they united against him. It was an overwhelming vote.
And I think something to keep in mind is Republicans have, and the party itself, the entire Republican Party, have an overwhelming majority, because this is just after the Civil War.
Right, that's absolutely right. I mean, they lose some of it in the elections, you know, of 1867, but they do have a majority. But it doesn't mean that they were, you know, excited about impeaching. And, you know, they had one of the kind of more, I suppose, trigger-happy of them wanted Johnson impeached as early as 1867. And, you know, others, even radicals, didn't quite agree with him. It was seemed premature. So the impeachment process was a long process. And as I said, it really was Johnson himself and his actions that united the party in a way so that they would vote overwhelmingly to impeach him. So it's interesting in that particular sense that, you know, they were not necessarily excited about, you know, I guess to use a cliche, changing horses in midstream. I mean, they really wanted to try. They were trying, from my point of view anyway, they were trying very hard to do end runs around the kinds of policies that he'd been really putting in place by executive order as soon as he went into the White House.
Can you give me a sketch of who Andrew Johnson was? What's important to know about Andrew Johnson and his biography?
Sure. Andrew Johnson was born in North Carolina, very, very poor. His father died when he was fairly young, and his mother, who she eventually remarried, but she was poor, and she sent Johnson and his brother out to be apprentice. She apprenticed them, which, you know, made him, in a sense, indentured, and he was supposed to stay indentured until he reached his majority, 21, which, when you think about it, you think about poor Southerners. I mean, he was not of the planter class or an aristocrat in any form. He ran away, actually, and his and where he worked, they put out a wanted sign for him. So it's a really hard background that he came from. He and his family eventually moved, and he married in Tennessee. And at a very early age, he entered Tennessee politics, and he was very, very successful. He was a very kind of good and powerful stump speaker. And eventually he went and he was sent to Congress. He was the senator, U.S. senator from Tennessee. And then what becomes interesting, a Democrat, a small government Democrat. And what became interesting about Johnson during what was called the secession winter of 1860-61, after Lincoln was elected and the, you know, southern states started seceding, Johnson was the only United States Senator from the South who stood up and very powerfully argued against and wanted to fight against secession. He wanted to preserve the Union. So that was really astonishing. And he was, you know, then he was hanged in effigy from one end of Tennessee to the other. He lost whatever friends, Southern Democrats, that he had. And the North thought of him as a kind of hero, really, and he was. It was a very courageous thing to do, and it put his life and his family's life in jeopardy. During the war, Lincoln appointed Johnson as the military governor of the Union-occupied part of Tennessee, which was, you know, a very important position. So Lincoln was, you know, Lincoln was very savvy. And in 1864, when Lincoln was running for re-election and he wanted to win, and he wasn't sure he would win. You know, we think it's a foregone conclusion. Of course Lincoln would be elected, but that wasn't the case at all. So what Lincoln did was he dumped the vice president that he had, a man named Hannibal Hamlin, because he didn't really bring anything new to the ticket. And he put Johnson on the ticket, Andrew Johnson, a Democrat, but what was called a war Democrat, because he was interested in prosecuting the war and saving the Union. So here you have a Southern Democrat on the ticket with Lincoln, who's considered a Westerner, you know, in Illinois, but also a Republican who's been in office. And Lincoln did win, you know, because of military victories, but nonetheless, that's how Johnson was on Lincoln's ticket. So here he was, a very courageous man, it seemed, intent on saving the Union, and he always was intent on saving the Union. But in terms of the other major, or the major issue of the war, which was the abolition of slavery, I don't think Johnson could have cared less. I mean, sure, he backed up the 13th Amendment abolishing slavery because it was the expedient thing to do, but it wasn't as if he was an abolitionist. It wasn't as if he was even anti-slavery. He believed that slavery was better protected within the Union than outside of it, and that was his argument to the Southerners. So here he was, as I said, a very courageous man who sort of stood up for what he believed. But at a certain point, it's interesting about, you know, how we understand courage. At a certain point, courage can become kind of stubbornness. And when Lincoln was assassinated and Johnson took the oath of office, many people were very hopeful. He'd been on Lincoln's ticket. He was a Southerner. He had said traitors, you know, namely secessionists, big-time Confederates, should be punished. And so it seemed as if he was going to take the Union victory in a direction that would actually, as I said, abolish not just slavery, but the effects of slavery. They got into office, and when he entered office after Lincoln's death, it's April 1865, Congress was in recess. And so many congressmen went to Johnson and said, you should have a special session to decide how we're going to, you know, put Humpty Dumpty back together again. And he refused, and he began acting on his own. So that takes you to pretty much the summer of 1865. I think that, and that gives you a sense of who Johnson is. And then at that point, we begin to see a different side of Johnson.
This is Letters and Politics, and we are in conversation with Brenda Wineapple, who is the author of the book, The Impeachers, The Trial of Andrew Johnson, and The Dream of a Just Nation. The impeachment of Andrew Johnson was the first impeachment of a sitting president in U.S. history, and that is what we are in conversation about. Brenda Wineapple, I just returned from Washington, D.C., where I spent several weeks covering the impeachment proceedings today that's happening with Donald Trump. I was behind closed doors.
Were you there yesterday?
No. I was doing the live broadcast from Berkeley. We're broadcasting them live, but I could do that here. I was there when it was all closed. Everything was behind closed doors, trying to figure out what in the world was going on. And I had this moment, and I actually have always enjoyed, when you have a press pass, you have just this unlimited access to the Capitol building, including at night when no one else is really in there.
Yeah.
And it's really a wonderful experience for me. And I was going through Statuary Hall, which is the old the old House chamber before they added on where the House chamber is today. And it's just full of statues today. And I'm just going and looking at every statue. Mm-hmm. And I came upon, in a moment of excitement, the statue of Hannibal Hamlin, the man that you talked about.
Oh, my goodness. How many people remember who he is even? Yeah.
And for me, it just made my night. It made my trip almost. I'm like, it's Hannibal Hamlin. And you mentioned him. He was Abraham Lincoln's first vice president from 1860 to 1864. He was against slavery, and yet he gets dropped, I guess, at the nominating convention for the Republicans for Andrew Johnson, because what Lincoln's trying to show is country unity with with Johnson. And you know, look, if you're vice president, it doesn't really matter. You don't really do anything too much unless you're going to, you know, decide a tie vote in the Senate. But yeah, it would
have. That's right.
And you just have to wonder. I mean, there's two moments in this story. One, how could, because I think we'll all recognize how Reconstruction, with these lofty ideas after the Civil War, would end up being so bad for Black Americans. And I think of two moments. One, the dropping of Hannibal Hamlin for Andrew Johnson. And the second being that Andrew Johnson just came up one vote short of actually being removed from office.
I know. Isn't that remarkable? Yeah. Really remarkable. Well, in the first, the dropping of Hannibal Hamlin, I mean, you know, Lincoln was a politician and he was weighing different options. And, you know, in spite of the fact it was war, in spite of the fact there had been assassination attempts on him, he didn't think he was going to be killed. I mean, who thinks that, you know, in a sense? He was thinking about the election. Thaddeus Stevens, who we mentioned before, was kind of disgusted at the fact that Andrew Johnson was put on the ticket. You know, he said, you know, can't you get somebody better than some Southerner from a rebel state? You know, but, you know, they were sort of grumbling about it. But it was, you know, at the time it seemed a smart move. You just never know.
And, yeah, you can imagine it today. It's the unity ticket. People will be for
that. Exactly, yeah. exactly. And in a sense, there was no way to have predicted that Johnson was going to be as, you know, stubborn, pig-headed, you know, as difficult as he was. I mean, here was a man who actually tried to campaign against the 14th Amendment. And that amendment, just to sort of, you know, give an overview, all it does is grant citizenship to, you know, Americans, black and white, and due process. I mean, it's not a radical amendment when you think about it that way. It was just a way to enshrine civil rights legislation that Johnson had vetoed. I mean, imagine that, really. And Congress, as you said, you know, had a Republican majority, and they overruled his veto. But even the moderates were shocked that he was campaigning against the 14th Amendment, that he vetoed the civil rights legislation. So when he finally was impeached in the House and the trial went to the Senate, as you say, the other shocking thing, kind of, you know, just amazing that, you know, history could have gone in a whole different way, theoretically, was that he was acquitted by one vote. You know, and that one vote, the senator from Kansas, junior senator from Kansas, who cast that deciding vote, he became, remember I mentioned earlier, Kennedy's Profiles in Courage. He got a whole chapter in Kennedy's book, presumably for being courageous enough to buck the party, Republicans, and vote to keep Johnson in office.
His name's Edmund
Ross.
Ross, Edmund Ross, that's right.
Right, right.
And there was allegations of corruption in that vote.
Yeah, right. I mean, at this distance, believe me, I would have loved to have been able to find something that actually proved how much money was, you know, was changed hands. But I can, and I, you know, it's in public record, how many times Ross, after he cast his vote, went to Johnson and said, you know, in gratitude for my vote, would you please, you know, give this person a job, give that person a job, take care of me, essentially. And it kept going back and back and back. So it's what we call today quid pro quo.
I mean, there was even a congressional investigation, wasn't there, into that? As to what happened?
Yeah, and some of those papers that I looked at are extant, because during that investigation, which actually was going on just, you know, even while the votes were taken, you know, sort of at the end of the whole thing, the testimony, people were so cagey. It was really like reading court drama from today. You know, I don't remember, I can't recall. You better ask this person, you know, what do you mean by that? So it was very hard to pin anybody down. And those are the transcripts that are remaining. There were transcripts I would have loved to have found. I'm sure testimony or depositions were taken by the Secretary of State, you know, from the Secretary of State, things like that, but I couldn't find them.
Again,
you can't really at this distance prove anything, and you couldn't then, but, you know, there was a lot of smoke, let's say.
Yeah, and again, just one vote short from being convicted removed from office. And it's not clear that even if he would have voted to convict, that somebody else might have changed their vote as well. So
Right. There was an allegation, sort of rumors going around that the people who wanted to keep Johnson in office had more votes in their pocket if Ross proved, you know, sort of uncooperative. But it's hard to know. Again, you just don't know. The fact remains that Johnson was acquitted. But from my point of view, you know, he was impeached. And you know, that is a stain, never mind everything else he had done, on his reputation. He will be remembered in history from whatever point of view as the first president to be impeached. It's not, you know, it's not what you want on your obit.
Yeah. No.
It's probably not what you want as
being the fourth president, but who knows? Maybe Trump will take this one as a badge of honor. What's interesting?
Yeah, I don't think so. But I guess that's another conversation. I don't think so. You know, and frankly, you know, forgetting Nixon, or who wasn't really impeached, but forgetting Nixon and Clinton, you don't want to be in the same company as Andrew Johnson, I don't think.
Yeah, no, I think you're
right.
But
you have to know who he is first. So
that's right. That's right. And. What's really also interesting about this moment in time, and who knows, maybe if Andrew Johnson is removed from office and replaced, maybe the history is just as tragic that would happen in the next few decades for Black Americans anyways. But it's hard to imagine it being any worse.
Well, except that he was, you know, I'm not sure that that would have been the case because, you know, he was tolerating, even encouraging so much violence, particularly in the South, endorsing, you know, formerly rebel legislatures, you know, that were now in power, you know, and the person who was going to replace him was a man named Benjamin Wade. And it's possible, as you say, we might have had the same history anyway, depending, I mean, I don't know how you could even know or evaluate that. It depends on how you view history. But Ben Wade was, you know, a radical Republican. He was progressive. To go back to an earlier question, he actually did believe women should have the vote. And one of the reasons people found Ben Wade so terrifying, they floated a rumor that Ben Wade had already put together his cabinet and had Susan B. Anthony in it.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know about the Susan B. Anthony in his
cabinet. You know, that was the kind of thing. It was like, oh my God, you don't want him. Yeah. He'll put women in the cabinet.
Wow. Now he's
better
not
keep Johnson.
Yeah, now he's not vice president, but he's Senate pro tem. We don't have a vice president at this moment. No one replaced Andrew Johnson.
Johnson was the vice president, and so was Johnson, if Johnson's removed, the way the succession laws were at that time, the senator pro tem, who was Ben Wade, was next in line for the president.
And pro tem basically means the longest serving senator, I believe.
Right.
Yeah. Brenda Wineapple is our guest. She is the author of the book, The Impeachers, The Trial of Andrew Johnson and the Dream of a Just Nation. That is what we are in conversation about. Brenda Wineapple, can you lay out more for me Johnson's approach with the South? And I guess what's happening here is he is favorably bringing the South back into the Union, while the Republicans in Congress want a lot more conditions set on the South. Is that accurate?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's very accurate. Congress, you know, one of the things that Congress is allowed to do, supposed to do, is decide the qualifications of its own members. So when you think about the South, the 11 states that seceded, the question is, after the war is over, what do you do with them? They had tried to form a separate country and they waged war on the Union. So do you just let them back into Congress and say, well, you know, it was a mistake, you know, we know you didn't mean it, and you can just come in just like things were before? And the other issue that's paramount, really, is that you have 4 million people, Black people, who were enslaved, and now they're free. And so how do you have them represented in Congress? Because if you just go back to the old legislatures and the old constitutions, then you have a whole population that's now considered full people. You know, in the Constitution, enslaved people are only counted 3/4, so 3/5 of a person. So now, actually, the South would have more proportional power if Black people don't have the vote, right? The white South would have more power. So these are really interesting, horrible questions. How are you going to do this? what Johnson wanted to do is just sort of let everybody back in, everybody meaning even people who had been higher up in the Confederacy or who had been in the Confederate military, when because he was pardoning them. And when Congress was in recess, he actually began sort of restoring governments and saying people, you know, that the South could go back into Congress, because he said they never seceded. Secession was against the law, so therefore they couldn't have seceded. And that's Thaddeus Stevens, very sharp guy, and said that's like saying murder is against the law, so this person didn't kill that person. You know, didn't make any sense. But that was the fight at the very beginning. So he started restoring rebel legislatures, which then were passing laws called black codes that was limiting even the movement of black people in the South. They couldn't make contracts. They, you know, couldn't marry, couldn't serve on juries. So this was pretty bad, which is why Congress began passing civil rights legislation that Johnson vetoed. That's why they also passed the 14th Amendment. So you can see that they're struggling. In the meantime, there's tremendous violence going on in the South, perpetrated against black people and their white loyalist friends or white Republicans. And Johnson is kind of looking away. You know, he's not really doing anything about it. And in fact, there's allegations that he's endorsing it. So what Congress finally does, it's trying to rein Johnson in, and passes Reconstruction laws. And one of those laws enfranchises black men in the South that they can vote. And they can vote and, you know, help form different constitutions, state constitutions. And, of course, in order to do this and protect them, the military, the South is divided into military zones, so that the southern states can go back into Congress once they have new constitutions and have let black people enfranchise black people. These military zones are, in effect, to send the army into the South to protect people at the polls. The person protecting the military is Ulysses S. Grant, who becomes president, as we know, and also the Secretary of War, Edwin Stanton. Johnson wants to get rid of Stanton. Congress knows this, so they passed something called the Tenure of Office Act. Again, they're trying to inhibit Johnson. They're trying to do end runs around him. But Johnson fires Stanton anyway. He's replacing the military people. He's doing what he does against Congress, and he's basically saying Congress isn't even legitimate. And so he fires Stanton, and that sort of sets the ball rolling.
It's a wild scene. There's like a 3-month standoff between Edwin Stanton and Lorenzo Thomas, I think was his name. I'm just off the top of my head.
Well, that was the Secretary of War.
Yeah.
You know, sort of odd interim that Johnson got, you know, that sort of sent over to the War Department. But what Stanton does is he won't leave. And in effect, he puts his arm around Lorenzo Thomas, and they have a drink together. And Thomas can't get rid of Stanton. And Johnson is furious. Stanton barricades himself in the office because the Tenure of Office Act says that you cannot fire a civil officer who's been placed in his position by the Senate. You can't fire him without the consent of the Senate. The Senate doesn't give consent for the firing of Stanton. So Stanton stays put. So it is a stalemate.
And just to be very clear about the Tenure of Office Act, and people will recognize today that when the president nominates someone to be in the cabinet, you need Senate confirmation. What the Tenure of Office Act said, well, if you're also going to fire or dismiss somebody in the cabinet, you also need Senate confirmation for that. That's what Johnson violated that law, and that's what they end up going after what, maybe a couple of years maybe of trying to impeach Johnson. That's the one that they're actually able to get enough votes for, overwhelmingly so,
overwhelming.
In the House. Yeah, to impeach Johnson. I guess it is important to note, several decades later, the Supreme Court would rule that the Tenure of Office Act was unconstitutional, so we don't have that today. Mm-hmm.
No, it doesn't exist today. It was ruled as unconstitutional. And one of the arguments against Johnson's, one of the, you know, arguments that his lawyers made, what Johnson's lawyers made, was that all Johnson was doing was testing the constitutionality of the act. That's what he was doing when he was firing Stanton. He was just saying, oh, this act is unconstitutional, I'm testing it. So, you know, when Johnson was impeached, as you know, what the House does after it votes for impeachment, sets up articles of impeachment, and there were 11. And most of them dealt with the violation of the Tenure of Office Act. And so, as I said, Johnson's lawyers were arguing that he was only testing the constitutionality, and that it was an illegal act anyway, and that furthermore, the way the act was worded was that since Stanton had been appointed by Lincoln, not Johnson, Johnson could fire him. So these were all very kind of legalistic arguments when the trial took place. There were, however, two articles of impeachment that dealt less with the Tenure of Office Act and more with the fact that according to Congress, according to the articles, Johnson had abused his power, and obstructed justice.
Let's talk more about Edwin Stanton. This is somebody you begin your book, The Impeachers, writing about. And I think it's important to talk about him. Again, the reason there's this Tenure of Office Act is Republican-controlled Congress is trying to keep Abraham Lincoln's cabinet in place. Edwin Stanton, who is the Secretary of War, is incredibly important in all this because, one, as you write in the book, he was a very close friend of Abraham Lincoln's. And then also just the role the radical Republicans, or just Republicans in general, saw the military as the way of enforcing a racial equality in the South.
Right. That's absolutely right. Stanton was a very interesting person, obviously a brilliant lawyer that was picked for, you know, Lincoln's cabinet. And you can credit him, along with, say, Lincoln and Grant and all, of course, the foot soldiers, but with helping win the war because, you know, in a sense, he kept the trains running. He organized the movement of men and material. He was efficient. He was obsessed, really. He hardly ever slept. I mean, for him, the war was enormously important, and he was so important in making sure that the military not only had movement, and when you think of, you know, moving these thousands of men by foot from one place to another, but also that they had munitions and food, and it was quite an undertaking, and he really did it all. He exhausted himself doing it. He had originally been he was a war Democrat, so he hadn't been a Republican. He became one, but he had been part of the Democratic Party, actually, sort of interesting background. But when he became a Republican, he was very close friends, as you said, with Lincoln. And as time went on, he was a real thorn in Johnson's side because he became more and more radicalized as time went on and really not only believed in preserving the Union, as Johnson did, but in racial equality. And at the time of Johnson's administration, and certainly before, the Army itself was instrumental in keeping the peace in the South, but even more than that, making sure that there was a kind of I guess you'd have to say stamping out violence and the kind of undermining of the rights of the formerly enslaved, the black people there. And although, you know, the military, there are a lot of people in the military had very different views, who were abolitionists from one extreme and that were, you know, what we'd call today racists at the other extreme. Nonetheless, many of them were so horrified, like Phil Sheridan, at the violence and the massacres that were being perpetrated on black people, you know, for no reason, really, that they themselves became what we would consider radicalized, whatever their real point of view was. They just couldn't tolerate this, and they didn't want their victory, the Union victory, squandered.
I mean, it's
so
this,
that's why.
It's this military in the South, isn't it, that Ulysses S. Grant would use to be able to put down the KKK? In the first iteration?
Eventually, that's absolutely true. Yeah. I mean, when he came in office, certainly, you know, his own attorney general was really helpful for a while in that. But that's absolutely true. You know, and Ulysses S. Grant is another case in point, because like Stanton, he became more and more allied with the so-called radical Republicans, because it was just sickening to him to see what was going on in the South after the war, when, as I said, the Union victory, it looked like it had been, you know, sort of squandered and almost meaningless. So, yeah, he was very intent, Grant, in putting down the KKK, and so was Stanton. And Johnson, meantime, was saying that this violence that he was hearing about just was propaganda. He didn't believe it. He didn't want to believe it, really.
And just to really hammer at the point of the importance of military rule in the South after the mm-hmm. war, if we just mm-hmm. look 8 years after the impeachment of Andrew Johnson in the presidential election of 1876 between Democrat Rutherford B. Hayes and Democrat Samuel Tilden, that election according to the Electoral College was basically a tie and very contentious.
Yeah, it was a tie, yeah. And very contentious.
And the way they end up determining who would be the president is they strike a deal. The Republicans from the North and Democrats from the South strike this deal. The South says, okay, we'll let you have Rutherford mm-hmm. B. Hayes if you mm-hmm. end the military rule in the South.
Right.
Am I right about
but
that?
But even to call it military rule, yeah. I mean, the military wasn't ruling in the South. By that time, those states, southern states, were back in Congress, you know. Yeah. But what was going on with military was, I guess you could say, occupying the South or being part of the South. And as I said, protecting black men and women and white loyalists, as they were called, or white Republicans. And the deal that was made, really what it did was undo all the gains of Reconstruction, congressional Reconstruction, insofar as they were ensuring due process and representation in government. So in a sense, what happened was Reconstruction was kind of diluted at that particular point, if not completely undermined, which, you know, is from one point of view tragic, really, at that particular time. That was much later, of course, and that was, you know, the country had changed in a lot during that particular time. As far as I'm concerned, the real opportunity was much earlier, and the real opportunity to really recreate a different kind of country was in that interim period after the war, and that if you'd had a Lincoln or a different kind of president, I think, you know, certainly you weren't going to eradicate all the, you know, evils that had been perpetrated by slavery, but you really may have had an opportunity to create, a fairer and more just nation in the South, and integrate the South much more quickly and less painfully than it was.
Brenda Wineapple, we're down to our final couple of minutes here. Is there anything, as you observe this fourth impeachment attempt in the House of Representatives happening today, that makes you think about this history?
Oh, I'm obviously obsessed with this history, and I'm surprised that nobody really delves into it, because if Donald Trump is impeached in the House, which to my mind, what do I know, but looks likely, and the trial goes to the Senate, it would, I think, be important for people to understand what exactly that means and how that's adjudicated, you know, what the role of the Chief Justice is, what the role of the senators are, and what the role really of dark money could be. But I'd also say this, and it's very hard to finally get a conviction. As you can see, if you look at the Johnson trial, I mean, it might have been different with Nixon, but certainly it's very, very difficult. But I would say that, as I said before, once impeached, always impeached, and Johnson will go down in history, you know, whatever sort of history once said of him, never that good. And he'll go down in history as one of the failed American presidents. The other thing I would say is impeachment is a reasonable and constitutional process that took place in 1868 without anybody dying, without, you know, any kind of revolt, without any kind of rebellion, and the country survived it.
Brenda Wineapple has been our guest. Brenda Wineapple is the author of the book, The Impeachers, The Trial of Andrew Johnson, and The Dream of a Just Nation. Brenda Wineapple, I've enjoyed our conversation very much, and I thank you for joining us to tell this story.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.